This is our Rouillet reading group, continuing our reading of Neo-Finalism. We're in Chapter 8, which we just started last week, and we're picking up from page 77 of the translation. So the last couple chapters have been getting into more, I guess, of the conceptual material of the book, as opposed to some of the earlier stuff was maybe more like an analysis of some of the factual material that he's basing his ideas on. So he looked through, you know, embryology and psychology material and sort of criticized some existing forms of explanation of some of the phenomena that had been identified in embryology. And then now he's sort of saying, okay, I've you know, demolished all these alternative theories, and now I'm presenting mine, essentially, is what we're doing in the previous chapter and in this chapter that we're in now. And so the title of this chapter is The Reciprocal Illusion of Incarnation and Material Existence. And so we saw this incredible line in the previous section that we just read last week, the beginning of this chapter, that the body does not exist, essentially. That's how we solve the mind-body problem, is that bodies don't exist. And that, of course, doesn't mean that the world or the universe consists of like disembodied minds just sort of floating around. It's that bodies are themselves minds or made up of minds. So any true form, any entity that has a real unity, whether that's a human body, the organism that is a human being, other animals, plants, whatever, these unified organisms, these are, insofar as they are a unified organism or unified entity, they are a sort of immediate self-perception or self-presentation, whatever sort of word we want to use. And that's also true of, a cell, insofar as that cell is a unit or an individual. It's also true, he doesn't really talk about it here in this book, but we saw in the cybernetics book, this is also true of atoms and subatomic particles. But notably, this is not true of aggregates. So a pile of sand, a rock, etc. These are entities that don't have a kind of intrinsic unity. One sort of volume unit of sand has no sort of intrinsic unity, in the sense that it doesn't care. There's nothing, it doesn't matter for that piece of sand that it is next to some other piece of sand or not. It doesn't have any sort of functional relevance to one, portion of sand, whether it's next to some other portion of sand or not. And then these two sort of types of entity, like a true form and an aggregate, are not just sort of two, categories of things that are separate from each other, because a living being, an organism itself, contains many aggregates. Of course, we have blood cells that are flowing through our veins in our blood. Blood is not itself a true form. It's just an aggregate of blood cells and other, fluids and other materials that flow through the bloodstream. Blood as such is not a unit. It's an aggregate. And then what he develops in more detail in the cybernetics book is this notion that he uses a sort of imagistic language. He talks about pipes. And so you can think, of course, of, the actual physical pipes in, plumbing of a building. And then, veins in an animal body, of course, would also be similar. But any type of system that sort of changes the probability of behavior of an aggregate is a pipe in the very broad sense. So like a pipe in the narrow sense, like the pipe that carries water to your faucet in your building, ensures that the water flows in a certain direction and not in others. If you had no pipe and you just sort of pumped water, it would just, spread out across the ground in every direction. But then if that water is instead pumped into that pipe, then it flows, downhill down that pipe into wherever the pipe leads. And so likewise, your blood, there are animals, insects, for example, that have don't have like a circulatory system in the sense that that we do. They just have sort of like a sort of rhythmic contraction that moves fluids around their body, but those fluids are not sort of confined to like a pipe or a vein or artery or whatever. But in humans and other mammals, etc., the fluids are contained in these systems of tubes that make them flow in certain directions and not others. So this is sort of like the general this sort of pipe pattern or this pipe schema is a general concept for describing how machines work, in the sense that they take some aggregate and constrain the behavior of that aggregate so that it does something it does some one specific behavior that otherwise would be very unlikely to happen. If you just pump water out of a cistern or whatever, for all that water to just flow in one direction would be extremely unlikely. But then if you have a pipe, you make this unlikely behavior very likely instead. So yeah, you're just sort of constraining the behavior of this aggregate. And this is sort of the general pattern for what a machine is. And so biological organisms are made up of machines, but those machines are sort of patterned or structured in such a way as to create this unit, which is the organism. So there's this kind of complicated, like, reciprocal interaction between, aggregates and their constraints by pipes that makes up the body of this true form or unit. Okay. So let's pick up on page 77 at the list item A.
I can read. Item A. A and B are two humans observing each other. Figure 24. A's reality for A or B's for B is the totality of his cerebral and organic consciousness, with organic consciousness distributed more or less in cellular or non-cellular sub-individualities. A's reality for B appears in B's cerebral consciousness as a perceived object, which B will call A's body, and vice versa. Because humans are social beings, A quickly adopts on himself for normal use the viewpoint of the observation of objects and not of pure self-enjoyment. Of course, it must not be entirely forgotten that A is above all a center of conscious activity, though young children and dogmatic behaviorists do forget this. Moreover, A adopts the dualist point of view on himself and, by analogy, on B, on all other humans, and on superior animals. He is consciousness and he is body. This illusion is even more natural because, independently of every social relation, man is constituted in such a way that he can be in a relation of observation, or even in a quote-unquote social relation, with himself. He sees his arms and hands extended before him, and he can speak to them like Lady Macbeth. He sees most of his body when he is seated or when he examines himself in a mirror. But the fact remains that if it were possible to conceive a human being living alone, without a mirror, with an immobilized head, incapable of looking at or touching himself, we do not see how such a being could have the curious idea of considering himself as double and as composed of consciousness and of a material body. If he were endowed with philosophical reflection, he would quickly notice a certain duality between his active, quote-unquote, eye consciousness and the more passive states of consciousness, suffering, malaise, euphoria. He would suspect that a hierarchy and a distribution exist in his conscious being, but this duality would not at all resemble in his eyes the old consciousness body duality. I'll read the second one too. B. A observes a tree and no longer another human B. The same illusion takes place. The tree is perceived as an object. This time, the analogy no longer forces A to attribute to the tree, as he attributes to himself, a self-enjoyment doubling its objective appearance. He hastens to consider the tree as a pure body without, quote-unquote, interior doubling, without a subjectivity of its own. If A is a biologist, he will analyze the operation of the tree's organs, but without any of the reservations that even the most obdurate materialist must experience when he examines a child or an animal. And yet it is clearly unacceptable to consider the tree as a pure body without a subjectivity of its own. Tree object exists only in the perception of an observer A, and the tree as a pure body is merely a substantialization of this tree object. The real tree grows and develops as a unity. It maintains its own form. It does not depend on the accidental perception of humans or animals passing in its vicinity, nor does it depend on the biologist's observations. The careful examination of the facts can lead us to suppose that the tree's unity is not as clear-cut as the unity of an animal. A young oak or a young horse chestnut has, for instance, leaves as large as those of an adult tree of its species. From this fact, we conclude that the tree is a colony of organs rather than an organism proper. But the more or less unitary modes of subjectivity have nothing to do with the general necessity of presupposing a quote-unquote auto-subject, a quote-unquote for itself, in the plant. The plant is subjectivity and not body, just like the animal. Yeah, so this is pretty much what Nan covered in the intro. But the basic idea is that a human being, or any other true form, is only a body in the sense of a kind of purely material object from the perspective of another true form that can observe it. So true forms, if they're individuated from each other, are bodies for each other, but each true form is sort of a true form in itself. And this is true, yeah, not only of human beings, but also of plants, other animals. And of course, for Rouillet, even very elementary forms like, electrons and molecules. This point about the tree being sort of a colony form reminds me of Simondon's discussion in the vital individuation section of the individuation book that we read, of these like limit cases. He talked about sponges for a while. Sponge is sort of the colony is an individual, but the sponges within the colony are sort of quasi-individual forms that are in a way closer to organs than to fully individuated true forms.
Yeah, this passage, I think there's a bit of a qualification of what I was the property of what he's calling here auto-subjectivity or itselfness of an entity on the one hand, and unity on the other hand. So this example of the tree. So there are many types of trees that, I was just confirming this on Wikipedia. Yeah. So a beech tree, for example, often has more than one trunk. So we think of like, you know, the trunk, you know, coming out of the ground, extending upwards as like a unit, as, you know, we describe that as a tree. But in beeches and some other kinds of trees, you have like many of these or several of these trunks that are all connected underground and are, you know, part of one individual in a sort of biological sense. But this individual doesn't have a sort of determinate structure or this sort of set unity. It's just that, you know, it has different shoots that come up out of the ground. Some of them get, you know, eaten or crushed or, you know, are in a bad whatever location. And don't survive, and others, you know, happen to survive and, you know, form a trunk that, you know, lasts for decades. So, you know, what the actual sort of form of this organism is, you know, depends on the sort of contingencies of which, you know, shoots end up surviving and which ones don't. So it doesn't have a sort of unity or this kind of determinate structure in the way that, say, a human body does or whatever. But that doesn't mean that, you know, any of these, or that the organism as such doesn't have this sort of self-presenting nature or this auto-subjectivity. So yeah, the degree of unification of an organism is not the same thing as sort of whether or not it has this auto-subjectivity character. And yeah, so these like the types of examples that Simondon talked about, like these corals and sponges and so on, that are like extremely unified as organisms, that they just sort of form these aggregates with other individuals or with other, you know, like you have a whole sort of group of corals that sort of fuse together. Their circulatory systems are connected, so one of them, you know, ingests something and then the nutrients just sort of flow all around with the whole group. But this group is not a sort of determinate unity. They can sort of split off, or other corals can fuse with it and so on. So there isn't really like a sort of determinate individuality of one coral. But it's still the case. I mean, this is not Simondon's language, but for Rouillet, it would still be the case that there is this auto-subjective character of the sponge as such, or of the coral. The corals have to make sure their you know, dietary preferences are all aligned. There's like a kosher coral community and then a vegan coral community, et cetera. But yeah, so this sort of auto-subjectivity property is not the same thing as unity. I think maybe though, going back to the first point, when he talks about the distinction between this sort of immediate self-perception, or sorry, perception is not even really the right word, but this immediate self-presentation or this for itself property, and distinguishes that from a sort of perception of oneself. So an example I think that maybe helps to convey this is one that Merleau-Ponty gives, I think, in Phenomenology of Perception, of the hand touching, and you touch one hand with your other hand. And so there's always a touched hand and a touching hand. So one of the hands, so the hand that is touched is a hand that you are perceiving as an object, even though, of course, you understand that this hand belongs to you, it's part of your body, you're still sort of perceiving it as an object. But then the hand that is doing the touching is not an object for you when you are touching by means of that hand. But at the same time, that hand is not... that hand that is doing the touching is not like a sort of disembodied spiritual entity. It's not a, astral body or something. It's something that is, a body, but it is a body that is sort of present to itself in that sense. It's a body that is for itself. So there's this sort of immediate for itselfness that is not a kind of perception. Like your hand that is doing the touching is not something that you perceive, but... at any moment, you can, of course, switch your awareness. You can say, the hand that was touching is now touched, and vice versa. And this sort of grasp of ourselves as like a dual entity, as a body plus a consciousness, is sort of a reflection of this duality between the immediate self-presentation, or the immediate for itself nature of the body, of the human organism, on the one hand, and then also the capacity to perceive, we can see our hands, we can, touch different parts of our body. You can sort of like see your nose vaguely, in the bottom of your visual field. Or you can see yourself in a mirror, et cetera. So you can sort of perceive your body in, or different parts of your body as an object. And this is sort of like the body of that body-mind duality. And then you can also just sort of live your body as this immediate for itselfness, and this sort of gets like transposed into this mysterious spiritual realm as a separate entity that is attached to the body in some way that we don't understand. This is sort of like he doesn't use the word phenomenology, but you could describe this as a sort of phenomenological basis for the mind-body distinction. Like what is it, what sort of experience is it that is being interpreted as a duality of mind and body, and it's this sort of like dual aspect nature of our experience of ourselves as either an object that we perceive, or as just a self-presentation of ourselves as living beings.
Yeah, for me, this section is about his duality, how he separates the mind-body duality as more of a duality in consciousness, the I consciousness, the cerebral consciousness, and the primary consciousness. And I also think it's important that he kind of states this this sentence. So he says, A's reality for B appears in B's cerebral consciousness as a perceived object. So our recognition of bodies is done with our cerebral consciousness, and but then when we recognize other beings like a tree or an animal as a body, that's obviously a recognition with our cerebral consciousness, and that's purely because we're not necessarily recognizing a consciousness in them. Obviously, we're recognizing them as a body, because that cerebral consciousness sees the real tree grows and develops as a unity. It maintains its own form. So it's a recognition at that level. So I think for me, that's kind of important in this section is that separation, and then how we tend to begin to rely on the cerebral consciousness. And then he's going to go on in a little bit to talk about.
You're cutting in and out a little bit.
Oh, I'm sorry. I don't know how much of that you got.
The last 20 seconds or so was kind of like in and out.
Yeah. So I was just saying, when he talks about when we're recognizing the tree as a body, or an animal as a body, we're recognizing that because we see the real tree grows and develops as a unity. It maintains its own form. So whereas perhaps there's a sense of a deeper consciousness in there. Since we recognize bodies at the cerebral level, we tend to only see these things as bodies with some kind of like deeper element to them than perhaps, as we'll go on to see, as like a cloud or a crowd. But we're not really getting to that deeper level of consciousness in those other bodies.
Yeah. So in the case of human beings, we of course have a social relationship of some kind, even if it's, you know, a stranger, you don't speak the same language or whatever, you know, your sort of degree of relationship might be very limited, but you still sort of recognize that not only is this entity in front of me, you know, a physical object that has, you know, has a certain shape and, you know, properties of various kinds, but also there's a sort of inner life of this entity that, you know, if I want to sort of interact with this entity in a way that, you know, I want to, you know, ensure we don't get into a fight or whatever, then I have to sort of take account of that inner life and try to understand what this other being is doing and experiencing. So just by virtue of having that sort of social relationship with this other entity in front of me, I am sort of attributing to it this, you know, inner life. But because it's not my inner life, it's not something that I have that immediate self-presentation of, it's sort of like added on to the body as an external entity. Like I sort of attribute, you know, a mind or spirit or whatever to this person as something additional to the body that I, you know, perceive in various ways that I can, you know, see and touch or hear or whatever. And then, of course, I can sort of turn that same conception back on myself. You know, I can see my body, I can, you know, touch my body, etc. And then I can take my own sort of inner life to be this extra entity added on to my physical body that I, you know, can experience as an object. And then, of course, this is, you know, different in the case of other types of organisms. When I look at a tree, I don't sort of have the same, you know, social relationship with the tree. I don't have to sort of try to figure out what its inner experience is to be able to, you know, navigate what the tree is doing. Mostly I can just ignore what the tree is doing. So it's much easier to just sort of look at the tree as a complicated machine that, you know, is pumping nutrients around and you know, doing all kinds of biological, chemical processes, but is still just a machine in that sense. But this, of course, is something that, you know, in many cases, or for in biology, it's often quite difficult to, on the one hand, to evaluate to what extent this sort of mechanical approach to an organism is like sufficient, you know, especially when we start getting to animal behavior and, you know, animals that themselves have complex social interactions with each other. You can think of like chimpanzees or whatever. And then there's also the problem of like anthropomorphism in the sense that, you know, we obviously look at, you know, chimpanzees or, you know, dogs or certain birds that are, you know, doing these things that we can sort of understand by analogy with ourselves. We can say that, you know, this animal is angry or it's scared of this other animal or whatever. We can sort of put ourselves into the place of this animal in a way that more or less makes sense for us, but it's much harder to put yourself into the place of a coral that is part of this, you know, fused colony existence, or to put yourself into the place of a beech tree or whatever. So it's hard sometimes to distinguish, you know, whether we are really grasping sort of the inner life of this organism or the extent to which there is an inner life of this organism, as opposed to just sort of reflecting which ones seem familiar to us, you know, the entities, the organisms that look like us or behave like us are the ones that we will treat as, you know, having an inner life that is important to take into account. And then the ones that have a very different mode of existence that is harder for us to sort of picture, maybe we are less likely to consider that there should be this, you know, other, you know, mind entity attached to them. But yeah, so for Huey, of course, the beech tree or the coral is just as much a for itself as the dog or the chimpanzee, or us human beings. Even though, of course, the types of behavior, the types of psychological performances that these entities can do are very different.
Yeah, I think that's exactly it. And I think we'll definitely be getting to this a lot more in a few pages. Would you like me to go ahead and read the next section?
Yeah, I think you can read C through E. I think that should be a good section.
Did you say D?
C, like e, cloud C. Through, okay. through yeah. E.
Okay. Okay, great. Perfect. Okay. C. A is a biologist who, by means of a now possible technology, observes the occipital cortex of B, who in his turn observes the tree. A sees nothing in B's cortex that resembles a sensation or an image of a tree. But if he electrically excites a certain region of B's occipital cortex, B will have a distorted and modified vision of the tree. At least, this is the most likely outcome, according to a direct inference from analogous cases. And indeed, this reaction can be a proof that the real cortex in itself, at least at a certain level of its bonds, is the subjective and conscious sensory field, and that it is this self-enjoying field that appears to the observer A as a gray and white substance, or as a quote-unquote physiological state of this substance. If A observes in succession B's cortex and the tree that B is observing, he will see in both cases nothing but bodies, because, unlike B, the tree does not speak and cannot describe its impressions, and because the observer has to be quite attentive and intelligent to interpret the relevant and finalist regulations of the plant as indirect signs of subjectivity, A will be tempted to see in the tree only a pure body that is subject exclusively to the laws of classical physics. If A were to observe the cortex of a dissected corpse, the observed appearance would not differ substantially from the appearance of a living cortex. And yet experience shows that this time, the observable structure deteriorates quickly. This is the proof that a dead cortex does not enjoy the same kind of internal bonds as a living and conscious cortex, and an excellent confirmation of what the observation of the living brain suggests. Some of these bonds are the very consciousness of the observed man. D. A observes a cloud. Because this cloud has no self-subsistence of its own, and takes very varied forms at the whim of meteorological conditions, it is no longer necessary to suppose that it has a proper subjectivity as a cloud. By contrast, the question arises for the water molecules that constitute it, because these molecules have a subsistence and a form of their own. It even arises for the step-by-step bonds between these molecules, which constitute the instantaneous unity of the cloud as a physical phenomenon. If A were to see a wave moving over a pond, they would be tempted to consider the wave as a body. A, more attentive observation would reveal that the droplets of water rise on the spot. The wave is therefore just a phenomenon, and the question of its proper subjectivity no longer arises. E, A observes a machine. They examine its structure and its operation. This machine has a unity, yet clearly not a proper unity, because its results from the play of amboceptors assembled by the engineer, and because, for want of maintenance and inspection, the machine quickly reverts to a state of scrap metal. No doubt, in both this and the cloud's case, the metal molecules or atoms have to be deemed, until further consideration, to have a, quote, for itself of their own, because they actively retain their form and their unity in the absence of any external maintenance. I'll just real quickly, kind of what I was saying earlier is, again, he's basically discussing how we tend to subjectify objects, only objects that we recognize an active cerebral consciousness in, and that we recognize within the object or the subject of that cerebral consciousness, being the brain matter itself. But that we tend to confer some some subjectivity to other bodies, but not at the level of a conscious subjectivity in those bodies. And
sorry, I was trying to find the French passage. I wanted to check a translation point. Anyway, sorry. Yeah, so as he's going through these items, you know, A through whatever, F, I can't remember how many it goes to. Anyway, he's going through these items. We're getting to sort of lower and lower degrees of organization or connection or whatever we want to use. So, of course, we start with, you know, human beings that we attribute this psychological subjectivity to. So that a human is not only this immediate self-enjoyment, but also has a sort of perception of themselves that, you know, I can see myself in a mirror. I can, you know, touch my hand, etc. I can become an object of perception for myself. And then we get to something like a tree, which, you know, has this immediate self-enjoyment property, but doesn't have a perception of itself. And as far as we know, you know, something like this beech tree with like multiple trunks, there's nothing like the, you know, one leaf on one trunk doesn't have a sort of perception of a leaf on a different trunk. There's sort of there's, you know, relations between them insofar as there are different, you know, chemicals that are you know, spreading, that diffuse throughout the body of this organism. You know, if like there's different trees, for example, like if they get attacked by an insect, an insect starts boring into the bark or whatever, it will release a kind of like warning signal that sort of disseminates throughout the tree, and then other parts of the tree might, you know, might have different responses that they might say release a different chemical that sort of repels those insects. But there's nothing, this is a sort of like a vague sort of diffuse response, as opposed to like one portion of the tree, you know, having a perception, oh, my other, you know, trunk over there is being attacked by insects. It's just a sort of general insect warning that is sort of disseminated throughout the tree. So there's no sort of like self-perception of the tree. It's not sort of treating itself as an object. And then you get to the example of sort of looking at an organism from outside using some sort of instrument. So he gives the example of like, you know, a neuroscientist looking at another person's brain. So I guess he would probably be talking about an EEG, given the time that he's writing. So this would sort of detect electrical activity going on in another person's brain. And you can, of course, you know, look at that pattern of electrical activity and identify, you know, which regions are more active when the person is performing a certain type of task versus another type of task. And that, you know, tells you, you know, different things about how different brain regions operate, etc. And so in this case, you're, of course, again, treating this person as an object, but you know, in studying the functioning of the brain, you reach this sort of according to Rouillet, if you sort of follow the evidence, you end up with this grasp of the brain as this absolute surface or this absolute overview, in the sense that you can't sort of treat, you know, each sort of portion of the brain as doing its own thing and then sort of secondarily being connected to other portions of the brain. And this, of course, is different than the brain of a dead person. If you know, are doing an autopsy on someone, that brain tissue will still, you know, respond in various ways. If you give it an electric shock, you might be able to make the muscles twitch or whatever, but it doesn't have this sort of absolute overview character anymore. It just, you know, the electrical charge will just, you know, sort of spread throughout the different parts of the brain in a sort of purely physical terms, in terms of like, you know, resistance and so on. And then, yeah, it might trigger something that looks maybe like a movement of a body that could happen in a living being, but is really just, you know, a product of electricity passing through the nerves in a certain way. And then the next stage he goes through is a cloud, or this is sort of like a typical aggregate. A cloud doesn't have a sort of form as such. It's just, you know, one molecule interacting with the molecule surrounding it. And, you know, as a result of the sort of humidity, temperature, et cetera, conditions in this region, it, you know, forms this sort of vague shape that we can describe as a cloud. that you know, you can classify clouds in terms of like how their altitude and shape and, you know, density and so on. But, you know, of course, anyone who's been on an airplane, you've probably experienced where, like, if you sort of are above the cloud, it looks like this sort of solid entity, this sort of compact mass of cloud. But then as you descend, you don't sort of like hit the cloud as a surface. You just sort of like the cloud just sort of vaguely gets denser and denser as you get like further into it. So there's no sort of like determinate boundary of the cloud. And so he mentions here, I mean, this is kind of an interesting case. He talks about like a wave on say a pond. You might sort of be tempted to attribute unity or a kind of structure to this wave. It's like a, you have like say a circular wave. You can sort of follow the circle as it gets bigger and bigger. And so it seems to have like sort of identity through time, for example. But you can also understand the wave in a pretty straightforward way, just as you know, the motion of water molecules or different regions of water in this lake or the pond that are, you know, rising and falling. The reason why I say this is an interesting example is because it is the wave, the type of wave he's describing here, or that he seems to be thinking of here, is a very simple one. Like, you just sort of drop a rock in the water and watch the circular pattern, you know, spread outwards. But there are also much more complicated and interesting waves that happen when, for example, there's like a vibration. You can get like a standing wave that has like a certain pattern, like, you know, crisscrossing lines or whatever. There are these famous examples where you sort of like, you take a drum and you like dust the surface with flour or something, some sort of fine powder. And then you take a violin bow and you sort of bow the edge of the drum, and the flour or the powder, whatever it is, sort of forms these like very intricate patterns called Chladni figures. It depends on like the shape of the drum and the size and then the frequency at which it's vibrating. And yeah, so you get these very intricate patterns that have this sort of structure to them. They're not just sort of this very simple, you know, wave motion up and down. So yeah, in some sense maybe the example he's giving here of the wave is too simple. Maybe there is something like a structure or a form that you can find in these kinds of wave patterns. I mean, we don't need to get into it too much because it's a bit off topic, but there's also this whole sort of sub-discipline in quantum mechanics that is basically based on this hydrodynamic analogy, that basically you can treat particles behaving in these sort of strange quantum ways as if they were sort of wave-like properties in a fluid, that you can sort of reproduce all kinds of quantum phenomena just by like a drop of oil bouncing on top of a bath of oil that is vibrating. And you get things like the double slit experiment, for example, where this is a famous, you know, experiment where the electron or the photon seemingly passes through both slits at the same time. You can actually reproduce the same phenomena using a drop of oil bouncing on a vibrating oil bath. So this like seemingly, you know, incomprehensible quantum phenomenon can be sort of reproduced as a sort of you know, vibrating oil droplet. So yeah, these waves and patterns of waves and so on probably have a lot more going on than Rie was maybe thinking of here. But the sort of general point is still, I think, true, is that there are certain phenomena that might be, you know, striking and interesting. But that if you sort of examine them more carefully and you know, develop a good theory, you might find that they are really just some sort of pattern that arises through this very simple interaction of like molecules or atoms with each other in a sort of local manner, that, you know, atom A is interacting with atom B and B with C and so on, but there's no sort of overall structure that generates a kind of pattern as a whole. Yeah, and then so to get back to this list here, so item E is a machine, which of course is similar to the cloud case in the sense that, you know, the steam engine is just a sort of aggregate of parts, except in this case, the parts have been assembled by a person or group of people in accordance with some sort of purpose that, you know, you put the parts together in such a way that they do something that is useful for someone, even if that usefulness is just like, you know, seeing the cool wheel go around or whatever. It's just sort of a toy. So the cloud is not, of course, assembled by anyone. It just sort of, you know, has each of these molecules interacting with each other in the ways that are, you know, produced by meteorological conditions of, you know, pressure, temperature, etc. The steam engine is put together by a person, and the parts don't just sort of spontaneously assemble themselves, but the sort of nature of these entities is similar in the sense that they are not sort of self-producing or self-maintaining. The steam engine, if you just sort of put it in a room and come back 100 years later, you'll have like parts that are rusted, or like, you know, all the sort of lubrication will have dried up, and the machine won't run anymore. Whereas, of course, living organisms, I mean, 100 years, many organisms would not be around anymore, but for a certain time period, they are capable of maintaining themselves in existence. They, you know, get rid of waste substances, they repair damage to themselves, etc. So the form of this organism is not just a sort of static existence, it is something that maintains itself and keeps itself in existence.
I mean, so if I'm understanding it correctly, at this point, he's basically saying the main difference between what we sense as bodies is just the ability to for the activity that gives rise to that body to that activity arises and is maintained from within that body in some way versus external sources.
I think, yeah, I'm not sure to what extent this internal external sort of generation is the sort of essential criterion here. I think what maybe a better one would be intrinsic versus extrinsic, which is not exactly, it's similar, but not exactly the same thing. So in the case of, maybe an example when he talks about like, sorry, where was that? Anyway, I can't find the exact place, but if you think of like a human body, you know, sometimes you find they're like these weird rock formations that sort of look like a human face or something like that. But of course we know that this rock formation that looks like a human face only looks like a human face for an observer. It's only, you know, yourself as or a human being that has a certain perceptual apparatus that is sort of tuned to detect human faces that looks at this, you know, pile of rock or this, you know, rock face or whatever and goes, oh, that looks like a face. There's nothing sort of intrinsic to this rock that is face-like. It's just a, you know, accident of geological history that, you know, made it have this particular form that humans would eventually find to look face-like. Whereas, you know, a human being, an actual living human being, you know, having a face or, you know, looking like a human face is not just a sort of contingent accident of, you know, biology or whatever. It's part of what it is that humans do, is to, you know, form themselves in such a way as to have a face. So in the case of the you know, geological formation, to some extent that might be a result of like external factors, like, you know, weathering, you know, water flowing through this canyon that eroded the rocks in a certain way or whatever, but could also be some sort of more, I guess, internal, you know, I don't know, like volcanic action that sort of produces rocks that have this shape. So it's not necessarily a question of like, is it something outside this entity or something within this entity that produced this shape? That's the important question. It's just that, you know, the fact that this volcanic process internal to the rock formation resulted in the human face is a sort of contingent accident. There's nothing about volcanic, you know, formations that brings about a face shape. Whereas in the case of human development, of course, there is something intrinsic to the embryo that makes it end up with a human face. It's not just a sort of accident of development that embryos, you know, develop into humans that have a face. I think it's this intrinsic versus extrinsic, or like accidental versus essential, maybe, distinction that is probably more important here than internal versus external, even though, of course, there's going to be a certain amount of overlap. Like many accidental processes will be accidental precisely because they are sort of affected by external forces or influences that all sort of come together in this contingent way to produce a phenomenon like the face on the rock or whatever.
Yeah, that's great. I think this is more a deficiency in my own terminology. But yeah, that makes perfect sense. And that word contingent is critical there as well. Contingent on non-intrinsic factors.
Right. Okay, so we can go on to the next bit. I can read this one. I think this might be the last list item. Looks like, yeah, okay. So I think we get a list item and then go on to the next bit. Okay, item F. A observes a man who is less fortunate than Aurelia's fiancé. This apparently is a reference to a Mark Twain story. I don't know which one. Less fortunate than Aurelia's fiancé. He lost his arms and legs and even some internal organs, but was reconstructed by a very advanced surgery thanks to plexiglass, quote-unquote, props, and to automatic machines that replaced his organs. Obviously, the man's artificial part should be viewed in the same way as the steam engine. In the normal organism, the parts of organs that are made up of dead cells, like the nails, the hair, the enamel of teeth, and so forth, have a self-subsistence only through their physical chemical components and their step-by-step bonds. More generally, their quote-unquote macroscopic organic operation is just a play just a play of amboceptors. We have examined a sufficient number of cases to be able to draw general conclusions. There is no body, that is, no material body, whose existential status is exhausted by the fact that it is purely and simply a body, massive and extended, without any subjectivity of its own. Mass and extension, spatial temporality, dynamic and geometric properties of bodies cannot be true quote-unquote properties. They cannot belong inherently to beings observed as bodies, but only to quote-unquote auto-subjective forms and forces, if we can use this strange term. Matter and material body, these terms do not designate a kind of particular stuff, supposedly different from a mind stuff or a domain of consciousness. Every real possesses itself. Otherwise, who would possess it? As B. Russell notes, the distinction between mental and physical, in a sense of quote-unquote material, here, quote from Russell, belongs to theory of knowledge, not to metaphysics, unquote. Russell is right in this sense. It is the, quote, mode of apprehension, unquote, of the real by the real, of the real B by the real A that makes the real B appear as a body or a material object. But we should also speak of observation and not of knowledge. I can know B's consciousness by sympathy, empathy, and analogy, and above all, by the unity of beings in the unity of a sense, without transforming this consciousness into a body. But I can only observe it as a body. And it is easy to account for this. Observation is a physical event, whereas knowledge is a mental act. A observes B, or the tree, or the cloud. This boils down to saying that his retina is the seat of the impact of photons that emanate from various elements of B's structure. If instead of vision, we were to turn to another sense, the observation would always be ultimately reduced to an energetic interaction. For observations proper, a photographic plate or a similar laboratory instrument can replace the sensory organ, often with advantage. If it were true that experimental science can be essentially reduced to a series of, quote, index readings, unquote, as Eddington claims, by eliminating all the, quote unquote, inobservables, in the sense that Heisenberg and Jeans gave to the term, as much as possible, or by leaving them to the domain of inferences, then it could be said that science observes and does not know. In truth, science does not relegate to common sense and to realist metaphysics the care of transposing the observed into an intuitive image of the world. It is equally realist, and it approaches observations with images of the real or, quote-unquote, comprehensive mathematical schemas. The discipline of, quote, possible observation, unquote, is no less necessary to scientific knowledge. It gives this knowledge its distinctive character. I'll do one more bit here. In everyday life, sensation is at once, indissociably, observation and knowledge, a physical event and an act of knowledge. It is a physical event insofar as a sensory organ is a system that can, in principle, be replaced by an artificial device. It is an act of knowledge insofar as the living tissue of the organ or of the corresponding cerebral area, or rather what appears as organic tissue to an external observer, forms part of the equipotential and subjective domain that is the very reality of the knowing being. Sensation is an act of knowledge and not a pure observation, insofar as it is the act of a being already in the world, capable of grasping significations and of having a sense of the quote-unquote other, a sense as primitive as the intuition of its own existence. Pure observation would never be knowledge, but only event, exchange of energy. Pure knowledge would remain virtual because it would provide no details about the quote-unquote other. It is the combination of observation and knowledge in sensation, in other words, of the living being's primary autosubjective organic consciousness and the physical events on the sensory organ that allows a, quote, detailed knowledge, unquote, of other beings. In radio emissions, the carrier wave is a physical reality as much as the modulations added to it. In sensation, only the, quote, unquote, modulation is physical, and the, quote, carrier wave, unquote, is the primary subjectivity supplied by the living organism. Because the modulation alone provides the content of information about the external world and all the details of knowledge, one spontaneously overlooks the rest, all that is auto-subjectivity, as much in the observer as in the observed. Moreover, common sense, without reaching the materialist or behaviorist purism of science, which tends to transform all objects, including humans, into bodies or into pure physical phenomena, is materialist for all the beings incapable of manifesting their interior life. Humans who lack imagination are, quote, malbranchists, unquote, about inferior animals and plants. Quote, it doesn't feel, unquote, Malbranche said about his dog. We are all malbranchists about physical reactions. Here he's sort of summarizing what we can conclude from this series of cases that he's gone through, looking at the person, looking at the tree, looking at the cloud, etc. When we describe an entity as a body, we are treating it as an object of observation, as an entity that we interact with in some sort of physical energetic terms. So if I see an object, it's because there's a photon or many photons that have bounced off that object and struck my retina and, you know, triggered all sorts of, you know, chemical reactions that eventually result in my visual perception of this object. And, you know, likewise for sound, smell, etc., all the other, you know, sensory modalities. So there's some sort of physical interaction between me and the screen of my laptop describe in terms of an observation. And so the laptop, in that sense, is a physical object because I'm interacting with it in this in terms of this exchange of energy. But then I also have knowledge of the laptop, and knowledge is not a physical process. It's something that has to do with semantics or this realm of schemas or ideas or whatever, melodies, themes, all these different terms that he uses. So you can't give a sort of physical description of what it is to know that what I'm seeing is a laptop. You can have physical processes that are involved in seeing the laptop, but the knowledge that it is a laptop is not itself a physical process. But that doesn't mean, of course, that it's a sort of extra physical process that is added on to the physical one. It's this semantic level of a sort of semantic character of the physical process, such that it is an instance of knowledge, but it's not, you know, knowledge as a separate thing that is added to the physical process. It's not a very enlightening way of describing it, but that's the best I can come up with here. As he's pointing out, this is not something that we feel the need to sort of include in our engagement with, my laptop screen, for example. Like, I have knowledge of the laptop screen, and I don't feel the need to attribute knowledge of me to the laptop screen. I don't assume that the laptop screen is also, aware of me or knows anything about me. Whereas in the case where I'm looking at a person rather than a laptop screen, I will attribute knowledge to that person. I, you know, treat that person as knowing that I am looking at them, for example. But again, this seems to have at least as much to do with how similar these entities are to us as it does with, you know, a grasp of those entities themselves. Animals that look like humans, that behave like humans, are much easier to think of in terms of their sort of psychology than, you know, these much stranger organisms like the coral or the tree or whatever, that are behaving in a very different way than humans do. And so it's much harder for us to sort of attribute a mind or an inner life to these other entities. And then we don't have that same sort of temptation of like splitting these organisms or splitting these entities into a body plus a mind.
Yeah, I He says here, you know, we know other primary consciousnesses through empathy, sympathy, analogy, the unity of a sense, but we observe them as a body, these mental versus physical events. You cut out for me while you were reading. Did you get to page 81? Did you get to, how far did you get?
I think I have some connection issues. I got to 81. Got to the top of 82, the first, partial paragraph in 82.
Okay. Yeah. This section, when I was reading it, was, there was just a lot in this section for me. And you've just kind of covered it. So I apologize if I'm just saying the same thing, but, to me, where he's separating this, sensation as a physical event and an act of knowledge. And it's physical in the sense tissue could be replaced artificially, and it's an act of knowledge in that it senses the equipotential and autosubjective domain of the object organism or object body. He says, like, quote, sensation is an act of knowledge and not pure observation. So pure observation is sort of just an event of energy exchange, whereas pure knowledge is virtual. No extensive event is required, and no, like, other object is materialized. So the way I'm reading it is he's saying a combination of the two is required in our sensing of other objects, other bodies.
Yeah, so the bit about knowledge of someone else's consciousness, I think here he's just sort of trying to avoid the sort of question, the sort of traditional other minds problem, is someone else's, experience of the color red the same as mine, et cetera, this sort of classic philosophical question. So that's not really what he wants to get at here. So he just is sort of accepting that in our, everyday interaction with other people, we can sometimes know, I mean, obviously we're not infallible in this, but we can sometimes know what someone is, thinking or feeling or whatever. If someone, tells us what they're feeling and they are sincere and, have a good sort of self-awareness, then we can just know what they're feeling. It's not, in that sense, it's not something sort of mysterious. Of course, people can, try to deceive us. They can, say that they are friendly to us, even though they're actually trying to trick us or whatever. People can also be mistaken about their own feelings. You might sort of, feel, or you might sort of think that you are happy, but there's actually a kind of dissatisfaction that you're kind of trying not to think about or trying to repress or something. The fact that there are these sort of like more difficult cases doesn't mean that in general we are incapable of knowing what someone else is feeling or thinking. Of course, communication in general would not really be possible if you could never have any knowledge of what anyone else is, thinking or feeling or intends to do or whatever. So in the case of talking to another person, there is of course the physical interaction that, the vibrations of this person's vocal cords are, producing sound waves that strike my eardrum and, trigger all kinds of neurological processes, et cetera. And I grasp some meaning as a result of this process. So there's sort of the two sides here, that there's the actual physical interaction where, some form of energy is passing from this person to me, and this sort of physical interaction is obviously essential to the process of oral communication. But then there's also this sort of semantic connection, in the sense that I grasp a meaning that this person is expressing in a sentence. So there's these sort of two sides here. And Rie is sort of asserting that these sort of two sides are always present in what we call sensation. So like if we're distinguishing between sensation and just sort of mere physical interaction, it's that sort of double property, double character, double nature of the phenomenon that is the important criterion. So, my desk, if I hit my desk, there's this physical process where, you know, motion is transmitted from my arm to the desk, and the desk will sort of vibrate briefly. Maybe, you know, something that I, like a glass that I have on the desk will fall over and spill water everywhere. I don't know, something like that. But these are all sort of physical processes that can be explained just in terms of the, you know, local interactions of different molecules that make up the desk and the glass and so on. But then if I, you know, hit a person in the same way, there will also be, you know, transmission of motion to this other person, but that person will also experience pain maybe, or surprise or whatever. There will be some sort of inner experience of that. And then also, you know, the person might grasp that act of striking as a sort of insult to their dignity, as a sort of expression of, you know, what I think of that person and so on, like grasp it as something that has meaning and value in this sort of semantic sense, as opposed to just a, you know, an interaction of bodies moving in space. And so this is sort of like the other side that makes it, you know, the, when that person feels themselves being struck by me, it's not just a sort of transfer of motion from one body to another. It's also this, it's what makes it into a sensation in the proper sense, as opposed to just a physical interaction of two bodies.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Organus.
No, please go ahead first. I've talked a lot.
No, I was going to say that's a helpful way for me to understand what Ruya is talking about here. And it sort of neatly aligns with, you know, some elements of like Husserlian phenomenology, you know, the hyletic and the noematic aspects of, you know, the phenomenological factor or you know, moments of intentionality for Husserl corresponds pretty neatly to the, as you put it here, the physical modulation, and then the sort of sensuous or semantic carrier wave being the kind of the noematic. So, in the case of striking the table or just sort of perturbing any other mere aggregate, in a way, it would be sort of just the hyletic moment without any of the noetic or noematic in phenomenological terms. I'm thinking about how, you know, the sort of distance between Ruya and phenomenology. I mean, as you mentioned earlier, there's the position on bodies that he lays out at the beginning of the chapter does seem pretty phenomenological. I think of Ruya as more of a realist, but, you know, even Husserl, you know, doesn't deny the reality of matter. He just argues that it's, you know, for us, it's always passing through this semantic carrier wave. I don't know the answer to that, but sort of an interesting point of intersection between Ruya and phenomenology.
That's kind of exactly what I'm taking from it as well. But really coming from a completely different perspective and background. And I think that's, you know, I read this book probably a lot differently than other people, because my background is pretty much for the last 20 years, you know, purely scientific. And this section, like, I really feel sort of called out, but also in a way vindicated because of what he's saying here and what I'm taking from it. So, you know, what you were saying with the wave, where you have the modulation, the carrier wave being the primary subjectivity, and the modulation being the physical aspect of it. And to our detriment, we have we've come to over rely on the explanations of the physical aspect, and that's caused us to almost only see these aspects of it. You know, at the top on page 81, where he's he discusses science relies on the physical observation, even with instruments that are vast improvements on our organic bodies. You know, the microscopy versus our retina. Like my avatar is an electron microscopy image, you know, so we could never see that just with our own retina. But we think we're explaining something, and we are explaining something, but what he says is, we're explaining the pure physical aspect of this. And, he says, slough off the unobserved and reduce the quote unquote seen to an index of numbers, and ignore the intuitive and all of the other things there. So for me, that's critical. You know, he says there at the top of page 82, humans who lack imagination are malebranchists, or about inferior animals and plants. Say they don't feel. You know, we've come to only like to equate knowing even and knowledge with the purely physical aspects of these things, but there are two aspects. And again, he sets up in this chapter that he is actually a dualist, but it's a dualism of consciousness, the cerebral versus the deeper primary consciousness. And you know, as I was trying to say earlier, you know, he equates the cerebral consciousness as our perception of other bodies with this. And to me, when he was talking about these other bodies that we're seeing, he was sort of saying we're not appreciating the depth of those other bodies. And the only reason we give consciousness to another human being is because we know our own cerebral consciousness, so we ascribe that to them as well. But even in other human beings, we're ignoring that deeper consciousness. And I don't know, for me, like, the way I stumbled into all of this stuff was that experience of my own in science and observations and how we were explaining things, and it just felt incredibly limited and lacking to me. And I feel like this whole section is just, you know, Rouillet saying, yeah, that's exactly right.
Yeah, I think an interesting bit here is when he's talking about the scientific experiments and how you can, for example, you know, maybe there's some sort of experiment when you're thinking of like these particle accelerator, you know, experiments that involve these like, you know, particles moving at like significant fractions of the speed of light and, you know, these sort of energy levels that are like incomprehensible, et cetera. Obviously, this is not something you can just sort of like watch happening in front of you. You have to like, you know, it takes like months to set up all the equipment, and, you know, you run the experiment, then it takes many more months to like analyze all the data and sort of figure out, okay, did we observe, you know, this phenomenon that we were trying to see or not? It's very like mediated through, yeah, many instruments, all kinds of data processing, et cetera. But there's still a sense in which you can describe this as an observation. And this is maybe like one of the more extreme cases, but even something as simple as like an optical telescope that like allows you to see the moons of Jupiter, for example, like the Galileo example, you're already doing something, you're already sort of using this device that, you know, has these physical properties to extend your ability to perceive. So this is not as obviously an observation as, you know, seeing the moon or something like that, that is just sort of immediately given to you, or seemingly immediately given to you. But even in these cases, like even in the case of the particle accelerator experiment that involves this, like, you know, inconceivably complicated mediation, we still take it, we're still not just sort of treating our, you know, scientific work as like getting the instrument readings to line up in a spreadsheet in a nice way. Like that's sort of like the instrumentalist picture, is that all you're doing when you do science is like, you know, checking your instruments and seeing what the readout is, and then finding a way to like, you know, calculate what the readout would be if you did X in the future. And this is not how the vast majority of scientists think about what they're doing. They don't say like, oh, I love looking at instruments and getting the readouts to line up properly. They say like, I'm fascinated by the structure of the atom or whatever thing they're studying. They want to, they understand what they're doing, and they explain what they're doing to other people in terms of, you know, learning about entities that are not themselves instruments by means of those instruments. But this, of course, requires this kind of semantic side as well, that like, you can only take this instrument reading as a sign of, you know, what this exotic particle is doing, insofar as you have like a whole sort of theoretical apparatus of physics at your disposal. You know, you've grasped the structure of this physical theory, and you know what this you know, if the instrument reads one, that means this theory is correct, and if it reads zero, that means the theory is wrong, right? In a very sort of simplistic case. Yeah, so you have to have like a grasp of, you know, what exactly the instrument is doing to even be able to sort of take that instrument to be conveying anything about an object, as opposed to just, you know, a pointer that is either up or down. And like if you think about, you know, you walk into like some lab setting that you don't know anything about the subject, you know, you don't even know what they're studying, and you just see some instruments that have like numbers and colors and whatever, and, you know, flickering lights. You have no idea, like you're not sort of able to use these instruments to grasp an object. You have no idea what it's measuring or what it's supposed to measure, if it's working properly, etc. All you're sort of perceiving is these instrument readings. It's only when you have that access to the sort of semantics governing this experimental setup that you can actually take this instrument as an instrument that allows you to observe something. And that's also true even for instruments as simple as, you know, an optical telescope, that it's only because you understand, you know, how lenses work, for example, that you can go, okay, this telescope is allowing me to see objects that would be too small for me to see otherwise. And this was actually sort of a point of controversy at the time Galileo was making these observations, because there were other astronomers who said that these supposed moons around Jupiter are just like sort of an optical illusion produced by the, you know, this bizarre apparatus that you're using, as opposed to the, you know, trustworthy, reliable human vision. And so, yeah, you have to be able to have confidence that this instrument you're using is actually reliable in this sense, that, you know, it's operating in a way that is giving you information about these entities, the moons of Jupiter in this case. But yeah, so it's only once you're sort of familiar with this apparatus that you can actually make an observation by means of the apparatus, as opposed to just like having color patterns displayed on your retina that you have no idea what they signify.
Yeah, I agree. I you know, my personal experience is you know, my background is cell biology and neuroscience, and we do, you know, I think we tend to reduce a cell to these linear step-by-step processes. When we do have some, you know, some new, I hesitate to say it, but I guess it's the only way I can say it, like advance in our understanding, we do sort of step outside of that and understand it more as a holistic process. Like, you know, that these singular entities are no longer as singular as they were, but so then we advance this in some way, but then we begin to reduce it again to what can be measurable, you know, a linear, you know, step-by-step individuated processes. It's by absolute necessity. So it's this ebb and flow in and out of that, but it continuously gets sucked back into that way of explaining and that way of knowing. You know, I mean, for me, this is sort of like a personal passion, is how can we not do that? I think for not just understanding how a cell works, but, you know, all the way out to our medicine and our social everything. I mean, to me, I think the exact way we end up doing that is impacts everything. I don't know. I'm kind of starting to go off on a little bit of a tangent, but that tends to be how science explains, though, what he's pointing out here, reducing it to index readings. And then the way I'm reading what he's saying there at the top of page 82 is that we have begun to do that, you know, across the board, as reducing everything to index readings, and that those index readings are real knowledge. And of course, index readings are quantifiable. They can be transacted, you know, they serve everything about our social, you know, society. So I think to me, this section was really important, what he's saying.
Yeah, I want to come back to that. Unfortunately, we have to end here because I have to head out pretty soon. But yeah, I want to come back to that next week. So hopefully, if you can sort of remind me of where we ended off, so I can come back to that. Hopefully, I'll remember what it was I wanted to say in a week. But yeah, okay, so have to end here. So yeah, thanks everyone for coming out. And let me just confirm. I think, yeah, next week should be good. Okay. Yeah. See you next week.